The Guardian.
Hi everybody, I'm Max Rushton and this is Guardian Football Weekly. Today, Chelsea win at Spurs, who still haven't won a game at Wembley in the Premier League. Manchester United could still win every game 4-0 this season, and as expected, they share top spot with Huddersfield and West Brom. Arsenal could have had three penalties, but Uncle Jesse gives Stoke the win. Also, Arnautovic's elbow, Ramos sees red again, Italy with Paolo, and confirmation that Lucas Podolski is not in a migrant gang. And that's today's Football Weekly. We have a panel. Hello, Jacob Steinberg.
Hello.
Belated congratulations on getting married.
Thanks.
You got married during West Ham's 4-0 defeat to Manchester United last week.
That was the plan. That was scheduled and everything.
Did you have it on a big screen?
No, but I had people making sure they told me that it was 2-0 and then 3-0 and then 4-0 during the photographs.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and the photographer was a Manchester United fan. So,
do you look... I mean, it's quite hard... I'll be honest, to tell the difference between your happiest and saddest face, Jacob. But like, did you look sadder in the photos? Or?
No, because I was fully prepared for what was going to happen.
Okay. Yeah. How optimistic are you? I asked you this last week. From 1 to 10 with West Ham, how now?
Well, I said 1 on Thursday.
You said 1 on Thursday. Has it gone up or down?
I don't think it's gone up.
Okay.
Maybe
half?
We'll keep it at 0.5?
0.5. Okay. Paolo Bandini, hello.
Hello.
Nerve-wracking news is that you haven't had any breakfast.
That's true.
Okay. It's currently 5 past 11. Do you reckon you can keep going until 11:50?
It's not a common state of affairs, but I'm going to try and push through.
Okay.
I've got some newspaper here I can eat if I get desperate.
Okay, if you're nervous.
Yeah.
And Ed Ahrens, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
Pod
nice
debut.
To be here. Good to be here, It's been a while.
Well, you're out of favour with the previous management, weren't you? And you trained in the reserves for years, and now you've finally got your opportunity.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to take it with both hands.
Okay.
So if possible.
Did you have any loan spells?
Several.
Okay, and several. How did they go?
Vitesse Arnhem.
Okay.
Boreham Wood. Who knows where I'll end up next?
Absolutely. Well, look, good luck, and you're very welcome. Shall we start then at Wembley? Spurs 1, Chelsea 2. Jacob, you're doing the minute by minute.
Yeah.
Even though everything was pointing towards the fact Spurs should win this, that I think most Spurs fans knew that they wouldn't win it.
Yeah, there's a certain fatalism amongst Tottenham fans when they play Chelsea, I think, which was evident when they lost that semi-final in April to Chelsea at Wembley. I think when they maybe went 3 or 4-2 down, there's a picture of a Spurs fan just going, "Shall we go?" Because I think they knew what was going on, and that's part of the brilliance of being a football fan at times, is just being pessimistic and knowing when your team is not going to win. And I think that's often the case for Tottenham against Chelsea. I didn't think they played badly at all. They dominated quite a lot of that, but I think that for Chelsea it was a huge performance given everything that was going on around it, the narrative that was building that this was going to be another Mourinho season. I think 2 years ago when they had that Mourinho season, they went away to Manchester City and they got absolutely done over 3-0. John Terry was taken off at half time, and that was very clear at that point that they weren't playing for Jose Mourinho. I think yesterday we saw complete opposite, even though they came in with a very makeshift side with David Luiz in midfield, something that Antonio Conte on his Friday press conference was asked, is he an option? And he kind of said, "I've seen him play in midfield before. I prefer him as a central defender. He said I might play a goalkeeper in midfield. That's an option as well." So there was a bit of snark and humour from Conte, but I think you could see yesterday the defiance and the resilience that was there from Chelsea, that they're behind their manager at the moment. They're not about to turn on him. And also it was just a really good tactical performance from Conte as well, with, you know, the stuffing the midfield, forcing Tottenham's creative players out of the game, really, I thought at times. And thought William was very dangerous in moved into a central role behind Morata. So I think, you know, again, an example of how good Conte can be in any given situation. Reminded me a little bit of when Italy played Belgium in the Euros, and they squeezed them and played on the counter with denying them space in the middle. And I think that we saw yesterday why Chelsea are champions. There's a lot more to come from them, but they still, when it needs to be, they can come up with that backs to the wall performance.
There was something very Sunday League Ed about Chelsea's winning goal. I mean, you're just watching Lloris. Chelsea have almost broken through. You just want your keeper to just hold the ball for like 5 seconds.
Yeah, well, I think Chelsea had targeted Wanyama because I mean, he's got a lot of talent. His physical ability, defensively, he's excellent. But I think on the ball, that would potentially be his weakness. And you could see every time the ball came to him in midfield, David Luiz was onto him. And in that particular moment when Spurs had just got back into the game and they'd been working so hard to get back to that position to equalise, I think they were a little bit too frantic trying to win the match when perhaps they could have settled for a draw, you know, at this stage of the season. It wouldn't have been a disaster. And Chelsea, to their credit, you know, they took their chances. They had two shots on target, I think, the whole game, and won the match. But yeah, Lloris would have been very unhappy with the second goal. Of course, he's a fantastic keeper, and you know that's the sort of thing he'd save in his sleep normally.
Is that one area where maybe we can sort of take this you know, the curse, this Wembley thing seriously? Not that it's a real curse, but in as much as maybe Tottenham, having got their you know their noses back in the game, might have had that extra sense of, you know what, we've really got a chance to do it here. We can smash this. We can end this conversation. We can go after it. And maybe that sense of sort of unnecessary urgency, as you're suggesting there, that sort of desire to really force the issue and try and get a winner, which is what Lloris was trying to do, hurling the ball out like that. And I do think, by the way, that David Luiz, who was just fantastic in that midfield, makes a really well-timed challenge to get on that ball and send it back the other way. Without that, it could easily have been a Tottenham counter. But I do wonder if that's those little moments when the urgency is just raised by the narrative, even though Pochettino would deny it.
Before we came on air, I was saying, you know, Wanyama could have given it to Sissoko, and then who knows what might have happened. And Jacob correctly pointed out, we probably know what might have happened. But the Wembley thing, I don't know. I heard Joey Barton on the radio, Jacob, saying the pitch at Wembley, and I've thought this, it's sort of slow and it doesn't zip like White Hart Lane. But having said that, I thought Spurs, if they play like that most games, they'll win most games.
Well, yeah, I think you do get that perception from the Wembley pitch that it does seem to move a little bit slower, the ball. The teams that Spurs have lost to at Wembley are a very good Monaco side, Bayer Leverkusen, who didn't do too well in the Bundesliga but were playing well at the time, and two defeats to Chelsea. I know that as well they drew with Ghent and went out of the Europa League. That did have quite a lot to do with a moment of madness from Dele Alli, who got sent off. So I think if they play like that in a lot of games, they absolutely destroyed CSKA Moscow last season at Wembley. So I don't think it's such a big issue for them. I think probably a bigger issue is the fact that they were bringing on someone like Sissoko, a bit of the Daniel Levy brinksmanship in the transfer window maybe comes back to haunt them a little bit there, because I didn't think they had a lot off the bench. Same as Janssen, you could see how much Pochettino trusts him, but the fact he brought him on only after they were 2-1 down.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the on the team issue, there's definitely, to me, it definitely looked like this conversation we're having about the wing backs. You know, no Kyle Walker and Danny Rose, presumably off googling Davinson Sanchez somewhere. It mattered. You know, Ben Davis and Kieran Trippier, they're not the same standards, those two players, and they might be good fullbacks in their own right, but they're not the same standards, those two players. On the Wembley thing, just not want to labour it, but I just think the other thing which was interesting was Conte's point, which is not even that it's necessarily about Tottenham and them playing worse. It's about the fact that every other team's having a day out at Wembley, and teams are coming there, and you know, it's silly, but they are treating it as a bigger event because it's a game at Wembley, and maybe that is creating something in the way teams play against them. I think that, and then the really subtle thing about just knowing where you are. We had this conversation, I think, years ago on this pod, and someone, I can't remember who, was talking about Thierry
Henry. I thought this pod had only been going for 3 weeks.
Absolutely. Thierry Henry had said something at a certain point about how when you're playing on a pitch you're very familiar with, you recognise things even as subtle as where an advertising hoarding is, and that gives you a sense of your position on the pitch that you just can get instinctively, and you move and you take your shots, you make your passes based on those little cues that you've got that you're familiar with. So I would have thought that sort of thing is just going to be, again, play a few more games there and that's going to come much more naturally.
Hayley was on Twitter as Tottenham Hale, saying, give over with that awful fake drumming. Sounds like someone's playing Jumanji in Wembley. I didn't notice that, but that would be infuriating. And Ram, on the subject of Conte going back to a suit, from a tracksuit last week, has there been a study of win percentage based on suits versus tracksuits worn by the manager? I don't think so, but you know, if somebody could
it's
do that.
It's interesting, though, because I went to the Chelsea-Burnley game last week and he was in his tracksuit for that. And he just, at the first half, especially when they were 3-0 down, he really just didn't look like he cared. But I think after the way that Chelsea came back in that second half, I think that was the catalyst for this performance this week, that Whereas Mourinho in the first game of the season 2 years ago with kind of the Eva Canero situation just lost his rag and never really got it back for the whole time he was at Chelsea. Conte composed himself at half time, I think, got Chelsea back onto what they were doing last season, and they almost snatched the point against Burnley, and then obviously had a great result on Sunday against Spurs.
Manchester United won 4-0 at Swansea, scored 3 goals in about 8 seconds in the second half. Spagbol asks, Paolo, are Manchester United unstoppable this season?
Well, I think that's the only logical conclusion we can draw from 180 minutes of football.
Yeah.
No, I mean, they were clearly the better side again this weekend against a Swansea team that is missing its star player, that's just sold Sigurdsson. Having said that, 4-0 did feel a little bit uneven for how the game went. So Swansea could easily have scored the first goal. Paul Pogba, and another referee definitely could have been off the pitch before he gets the header, which creates the first goal. Things could have gone differently, but they were markedly better than Swansea, and that shouldn't be a surprise. And Mourinho himself said it. They won their first two games last season. In fact, they won their first three games last season. Let's take it a little slower than that.
Their next fixtures are Leicester, Stoke, Everton, Southampton and Palace. They don't face a side from last season's top five until the middle of October. It's a nice way to start a season.
Yeah, well, last season they had the very early game after, I think they did win the first three, and then they played Manchester City and they lost 2-1 at home, and the wheels slightly went off in September last season. I thought that I didn't think they were that fluent, United, on Sunday, but they do look a bit more like a classic Mourinho side at the moment, and he's got so many attacking players that he is quite a pragmatic man, and I think he's realised that the best way for them to go forward at the moment is to try and get as many of these guys in. I was wondering if he might, in an away game, put in Ander Herrera instead of someone like Mata or Mkhitaryan. Instead, they all play because they've got the protection of Matic now, and that let Pogba go forward. And I thought that they just had so many players on the pitch, and then also on the bench. Martial came off the bench and scored the fourth goal, that even if they're not playing that well, they've still got the potential all the time to suddenly just steamroller through you.
Adam writes, Zlatan is rumoured to be returning back to United. Would him returning aid the squad or disrupt a new balance established with Lukaku? Jacob.
It depends if he would be happy to sit on the bench. One of their best performances last season actually came with him out of the side when Marcus Rashford started up front against Chelsea, and they had much more mobility. Rashford, I know he didn't score many goals last season, but he scored after 1 or 2 minutes in that one, and he just troubled Chelsea so much more. I think Zlatan obviously was really good for United last season, scored loads and loads of goals. He also missed quite a lot of chances in those games that they drew, which cost them top four in the end and a title challenge at the same time. I wonder if his lack of pace and mobility would be a hindrance to this side if he was to come back and be the first choice starter now that Lukaku settled in straight away. And as we've seen with Lukaku in the past few seasons, he does punish those sides in a way that Ibrahimovic didn't last year.
Do you think there's any chance we get
an Ibra post-career in something? You know, like Tim Visa went off to the WWE.
Like Frank LaBeouf became an actor, and you're watching, what was the Stephen Hawking film? I can't remember. And you just, there was a film and Eddie Redmayne. Was Eddie Redmayne Stephen Hawking? I forget. But anyway, it just, I don't remember all the details, but I remember being in the cinema and then he's in hospital and his doctor is Frank LaBeouf. And so half the cinema are like, well, that's just a French actor. And half the cinema are like, what's Frank LaBeouf doing there? I think Zlatan could go many ways, couldn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a shame that he wasn't of a generation before, because he could have made a cameo along with Meatloaf in Fight Club. He would have been ready made for it.
Well, there's hope. I'd love to. Yeah, I would almost prefer him to do that than go back to football.
he may become a qualified dentist like Hugo Sanchez.
Is that what Hugo Sanchez did?
He was also a qualified dentist.
And who became a police officer? Ariane Dazou.
Oh, and Kevin Francis from Stockport. Remember him? He's a Mountie. He's a Mountie.
Stop it.
He is.
But he's like bigger than a horse, isn't he?
He's 6'7". Yeah.
And he's a Canadian Mountie.
He's a Canadian Mountie.
Oh, that's fantastic. Stoke 1, Arsenal 0. See Fitzgerald Morgan on Twitter writes, were Spurs more Spursy or Arsenal more Arsenal-y this weekend? Arsene Wenger complaining about offsides and penalties. I thought they were a bit unlucky.
I mean, to be truly Arsenal-y, they would have had to build up a sizable lead before throwing it away. So arguably not peak Arsenal. But I think Arsenal were unlucky. I think when you go at all the sort of statistical side of things, like expected goals, yeah, they should have scored in that game. Danny Welbeck missed a bunch of chances. Alexandre Lacazette was offside, but it was a fraction. It was as narrow an offside as you're ever going to see. And arguably could have had a penalty as well, maybe more than one. But at the same time, this does feel awfully familiar. So yeah, it's and there's definitely questions to ask about that centre-back situation again. Wenger talking about him being disappointed himself with the performance of centre-backs. Well, you know, you didn't use all of your centre-backs. Rob Holding, who admittedly had a bad game on the opening weekend, I thought that one of the reasons that I would have thought Rob Holding had that bad game on the opening weekend is because he had no centre-backs alongside him, and you'd hope that with Mustafi there, he'd look a bit more comfortable, and he didn't get that chance. But yeah, there was something predictable about the way it went down for Arsenal, but certainly a very nice debut for Heze for Stoke.
Oh, I want to call him Jesse, and I just think of Uncle Jesse from Dukes of Hazzard whenever his name. But it's Heze, is it?
Yes.
Okay, right. Ed, did you like Arsene Wenger complaining after the game?
I enjoyed it. Yeah, he's becoming having more of a knack as he gets older and older in spouting spurious facts, which have.
It's what happens to all of us, doesn't it?
But when he says, "I'll go and check them," then Paul Doyle, who did the game yesterday, check the facts, and they were just totally wrong about how many penalties that Arsenal have conceded.
Is Arsene Wenger's post-football career Football Weekly then?
I think it could fit in quite well, actually, yeah. Or maybe on the website.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I mean, it was a classic Arsenal performance. I went to the Stoke game in May when Arsenal won 5-1 and they just blew them away. But it was, that was, you know, the pressure was off. They knew they weren't going to come fourth, and it was Stoke were really struggling at that time as well. But a few months makes a massive difference, just because, you know, with the pressures on Arsenal again. I know they had a good result in their first game, but I think that the glaring problem with Arsenal, which is continuation for many seasons, as well as the defence, which he doesn't seem to have a long lasting plan with, but his central midfield. I think Xhaka just, you know, made some mistakes and gives the ball away, and Wenger actually called him out on that after the game. And I'm not sure how long he can last in there. It's such an important position, and compared to some of the other contenders for the top four, Arsenal are really, really behind in central midfield, I'd say, despite having a large number of players. I don't think any of them are particularly up to it.
We'll do one more game in part one. Jacob, Southampton 3, West Ham 2.
Yeah.
As a West Ham fan, it's almost the worst way to lose a football match, I would suggest.
They're probably worse, I don't know, lose 10-0.
No, I think you, when it gets to, you know, I've seen Cambridge lose 6 on a number of occasions, and
yeah,
actually by about 3 or 4 you start to enjoy it in a sort of masochistic way because there's no hope. But you had hope. That's the thing that kills you, isn't it?
Yeah, hope, but there was 10 minutes left, and Slaven Bilic's team have now conceded 91 goals in their last 50 league matches, which goes back to his insane decision to try and turn Mikel Antonio into a right back at the end of his first season, at which point they conceded 20 goals in the last 10 games, and that just continued into last season. Hasn't been solved. They lost Winston Reid in the warm-up yesterday, on Saturday, to a calf injury, and Ogbonna came in alongside Jose Font, who we spoke about on Thursday, signed for £8 million. Last season he conceded 4 penalties, I think was the stat on match of the day. He conceded another one yesterday. He was caught out on Saturday, and he was caught out for the first goal as well by Gabbiadini, and they just seem to lack so much organisation at the back, and there were question marks on the first goal as well for Joe Hart. People with a bit more goalkeeping knowledge than me suggesting that he has a problem going down on his left side, because that wasn't a particularly well-struck shot by Gabbiadini.
Barry yesterday on the radio was making the point that Joe Hart is one of the worst goalkeepers at putting off centre forwards at penalties, because he tries really hard and then they always score them.
Well, he was trying to put off Charlie Austin before that last-minute penalty. And at the same time as well, Austin said that Mark Noble was saying to him, Hart knows which way you're going. Hart knows which way you're going. So he changed sides.
And just looking at the stupidest red card of the season, would anyone put Arnautovic's higher than Shelvey's? I was keeping a list through the season. I mean, they're close, aren't they? He really had to...
Hard to separate them, really. Is,
but Arnautovic really had to get his elbow there. It's like when Shelvey stepped on Ali, you know, his ankle was there quite close to him. I mean, it was a lot of effort to get there.
Wasn't obvious. I mean, there was no way that Arnautovic was going to get away with that, was there? Because he had to, like you say, he had to lean across. It was in front of everyone. Whereas Shelvey's was a little bit subtle, I suppose.
It was nice to see.
It was in front of the ref.
Yeah. It's nice to see Arnautovic complaining afterwards. What are you complaining about? Victor asks, Jacob, will West Ham have the best stadium in the Championship?
No. But they might be in the Championship.
Right, that'll do for part one. We'll look at the rest of the Premier League, do a bit of Football League as well, and look ahead to Manchester City, Everton, for those people listening before that game has happened. And we'll do that after this short break. Welcome back to part two. Let's look at the Premier League, rest of the games. Nicholas Bampton writes on Twitter, if you want to appease pun-hungry post-Jimbo listeners, feel free to use this one for the Huddersfield-Newcastle game. Moy Mounier, moy problems for Newcastle. Rafa says they're not ready for the Prem, Jacob.
They didn't look very ready yesterday. They acquitted themselves quite well against Tottenham before Jonjo Shelvey's moment of madness that got him sent off. But yesterday I thought they were poor. They really struggled with Huddersfield's pressing high up the pitch, and they kept giving the ball away. They did have an early chance where I think it was Matt Ritchie, a great save from the Huddersfield goalkeeper. But they lack so much firepower up front, I think. You look at Dwight Gayle, you wonder if he's really the man to lead you through a Premier League season up front, and I'm not sure that Hosolu did a lot of Stoke to suggest that he can provide them with the goals either. Benitez size, they're always going to be well organised, and I don't think they were total shambles by any means yesterday, but they seem to lack something and needs sorting out before the transfer window shuts.
Is it just me? Dwight Gayle looks like he's got a very old man's face. Sort of
he
Benjamin
does.
Button-y.
He really does, doesn't
yeah.
he? Yeah, I remember when he first came through at Peterborough, even then, he was he looked about 30.
Yeah.
But at the same time, kind of babyish as well.
Yeah, it's funny. It's the Benjamin Button of the Premier League. I can't really remember how Benjamin Button went. Does that work as an analogy?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
They spent roughly the same as Huddersfield over the course so far over the course of the summer, around 35 million each, roughly that figure, I think. But so far, it looks like Huddersfield have done much better in the transfer market, and you wonder how much longer Benitez will take this.
Aaron Moy does look like a very good player, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, clearly someone who buys into the work ethic that, you know, is what's worked for Huddersfield. And I think it was interesting comments afterwards about him being someone who doesn't smile an awful lot. But, you know, he's making I don't know. It was a good performance.
Ross asks, after a solid start, can we now consider West Brom title challengers? Their second 1-0 win at Burnley. Pulis versus Dyche. They could win every game 1-0 this season, the whole season.
You never know. You never know. As somebody who predicted them to go down, I'm probably not the best person to answer. No, I'm very impressed with them. And they've kind of got back to what they were doing at the start of last season when they also had a really good start. Obviously, Johnny Evans isn't around, but Hagazi, the Egyptian international, has come in and done brilliantly there. He's played in Italy before, so he's had some experience of European football. But yeah, really solid unit. And despite losing Darren Fletcher as well, they've really not let that affect them. And two wins out of two is a perfect start for Pulis.
Robson Kanu, only the fourth player in Premier League history to score and be sent off after coming on as a substitute. I thought he took his goal really well, and I thought he was unlucky to get sent off. Hmm. Agree with that?
Yeah, they've just got 34 more points and they can clock off.
Liverpool eked out a win against Crystal Palace. Ed, you're a Palace fan.
I am indeed.
Now, would you have taken a 1-0 at the start of the day?
Well, they played pretty well by the sounds of it and what I've seen. It was just a silly mistake at the end, and Mane just latched onto it and put it away, which, you can't give him those sort of opportunities. But yeah, compared to the Huddersfield debacle on the opening day, I think it was a lot more promising. But obviously without Zaha now for, perhaps more than 4 weeks, we'll see. It's going to be difficult for them, but against Swansea this weekend, it's a very important game.
Ads asks, is Leicester's Harry Maguire better than John Stones, Paolo?
No.
Thanks very much. John Stones, Man City play Everton tonight. Interesting to see. Is Sigurdsson ready now? Do we know if he can go into that
should be able to.
I think he's a fantastic signing, by the way.
Do you?
Yeah. I mean, I think Sigurdsson is one of those players who's genuinely, even after sort of being an incredibly productive player, still a bit underrated. And I know I was having a conversation just the other day about this sort of idea that, oh, is he good enough for a top four side, though? But actually, Pochettino basically had him sold out from underneath him. He was literally 2 hours away from starting in a friendly, and he got a message saying, oh, we've sold him. And I think Pochettino's basically said, yeah, he's a good player, and we'd have him around at Tottenham. So, yeah, I think he could well be in the top four side. I think he definitely ran further than anyone else in the Premier League last year. He's created more chances from set pieces than anyone else over the last 3 years. Yeah, I think he's a really valuable asset to a team.
All right. A quick Championship Football League roundup. Wolves lost at home to Cardiff in the title decider in the Championship. Well done to Ipswich. 100% record for Mick McCarthy. Villa's crisis is over. They beat Norwich 4-2. And Harry Redknapp, going a step further than Rafa, just said, these players aren't good enough, and had a massive old rant. Chris asks, why are the two teams with the most shots taken in the Championship, Millwall and Brentford, in the last two places? Which is an interesting stat, I presume, because they're not very good at hitting the target. And I'm just going to keep a little tally of teams with no wins. Bolton, Millwall, Brentford and Fulham in the Championship. Fulham have drawn three. In League One, no wins for Gillingham, Rochdale, AFC, Wimbledon, and no points at all for Northampton and Oldham. And in League Two, no wins for Lincoln, Colchester and Crawley. And no one's got a 100% record in League Two.
Just to pivot back to the Premier League for a second, I saw a random stat earlier today. First time since 1969, five teams with no goals after two games.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Five teams, no goals.
Is that the death of the Premier League? Has the bubble burst?
That's it.
Paolo, Serie A.
Yeah.
Big wins for Inter, Juve and Milan.
Yeah, it was an entertaining first weekend. Everything, it's all about the VAR. It's all about the video refereeing and...
how much VAR did we have?
Oh, so much VAR.
Oh, great.
There was VAR right from the first game. A penalty against Juventus caused by VAR at home, which is exactly the sort of thing that it's supposed to do, right? Is to get rid of referees' inherent biases that favour the big teams at home. And then Farias took a really awful penalty and Buffon saved it anyway. Juventus sort of put to bed the idea that they were completely undercooked for this season by winning very easily against a team that you'd expect them to beat. Milan thumped Crotone 3-0 away from home, which on the one hand is again a team you absolutely expect them to beat, and Crotone had a man sent off after 3 minutes, but they did draw there in April, so it's signs of progress. Inter, really impressive in patches against Fiorentina. Really sort of fast out the blocks. I thought Mauro Icardi looked sharp, and Ivan Perisic. I think with Perisic is, and to an extent the same with Icardi, is Perisic has always played games like this. The problem is getting him to do it for 38 games over a season, but they were really direct. Borja Valero, who'd come there from Fiorentina, having a great game against Fiorentina, and a great visual metaphor, I thought, because Valero has signed from Fiorentina and they love him in Florence. He loves Florence. He's got the coordinates of the Ponte Vecchio literally tattooed on his arm. That's how much he loves the city. He didn't really want to go, but
easier to get the coordinates than the Ponte Vecchio, isn't it?
Certainly a simpler design. Yeah. Someone who loves the team and the city, and you know, wasn't eager to go, but at this point in his career wanted this chance to go and compete for something bigger, and the club hadn't made that happen for him in Florence. So to see him doing that against them, painful enough. And then the man who's sort of replaced him in that midfield, Marco Bonassi, quite literally getting a very hard kick in the knackers from Borja Valero, felt like a great visual metaphor for everything that had happened to Fiorentina this summer. But yeah, they were good as well. And Napoli winning 3-1 at Verona meant that all the sort of big teams that we were hoping would come out the new season looking sharp started well, except possibly Roma, who still won the toughest game of the lot on the way to Atalanta, but were deeply underwhelming in doing so.
Damir Kulas asks, Paolo, with much of the talk centred on their City rivals over the summer, can Icardi and Spalletti lead Inter to a title challenge?
Yeah, I think that Juventus are favourites this season, and I think that if it's not Juventus, I personally think Napoli are the next best team. But Milan and Inter, I don't see that there's any reason why Milan should be streets ahead of them. Milan spent more this summer, but that's a much bigger reconstruction job. Inter spent 130 odd million last summer. They spent 70 million this summer. They haven't exactly been shy with their money. They had a squad already last year that should have been capable of a lot more than it was. And Luciano Spalletti is a very good manager. My concern for them is whether or not old habits die hard. And in this game, as in past seasons, they were drastically different proposition in the second half to what they'd been in the first half. And if they do that against a sharper, better team than Fiorentina, then they're going to have some problems. But the squad that is there is, I would say, not far off the same strength as Milan's.
Do you think Roma will come back for Mahrez?
It's hard because the market has run away from them so far now. I mean, Mahrez, I saw Craig Shakespeare was praising him and saying, you know, he's done a good job of being professional and working hard even after saying he wants to go. He clearly does want this move. But the amount of money they're talking about, 30-odd million in this market, that doesn't seem realistic, does it? It doesn't seem like you're anywhere near the right level. So unless they're prepared to go a good chunk higher, I'm not sure I see it happening.
Yeah, it seems unlikely at this stage because I think the offers have been going up very, very incrementally, like sort of a million or 2 million euros every time. And I think Roma are quite short of cash. John Serri,
what did Leicester want?
They were in for him 50? Earlier. Yeah, I think 50 is the figure that they were after, but obviously that no one's going to get near that now, despite the transfer markets. I think the likelihood with Mahrez, it'll be a last minute thing.
The thing for Roma is, they got the automatic Champions League place this year, which should have been the cue to allow them to spend money. They haven't. They've sold and they haven't brought in anyone of sort of any major signing so far this summer. Now they have got this new stadium they're trying to build, and that's a big concern. But actually, the fact of what Milan and Inter are doing now really changes our dynamic for those top four places. That their project is definitely explicitly, because James Pilotta has said it hundreds of times, including to me directly, it's built on being in that Champions League. They need to be in there. And if Milan and Inter are doing this and they end up running ahead of them, then not spending now could come to look really, really foolish. But it doesn't seem like the way they're behaving in this transfer window, they're about to up that bid to me.
Do you think, on the Mahrez thing, if you compare him to what he's doing to Van Dijk and Coutinho, do you actually think it makes it less likely that he'll go? I mean, it's almost counterintuitive. You think he should deserve the move more because he's actually being a professional?
Well, it depends on the club, doesn't it? I mean, I think it really depends on how you treat people as a club. People have talked about Bonucci's move this summer and the fact that Juventus didn't make him go abroad, which they, you know, could have done. And part of that was to do with his son and treatment he's being able to get close to home. And part of that is to do with your sort of familial relationship with players and whether you're willing to treat them. And I guess a bit of Petr Cech and Arsenal when Mourinho said, you know what, I don't want you to go there, but I'll let it happen because of the relationship we have. I think it can play in your favour, and at the moment it doesn't look like Coutinho and Van Dijk are getting what they want either, so I don't know if it's necessarily playing any better for them to be playing hardball.
Mahrez obviously went on the offensive straight away, wasn't it? The first statement was, I think, just at the end of the season, saying, I don't want to be here anymore, I want to leave. And then he's done another one, hasn't he, a couple of weeks ago. So he's tried to be honest, I suppose, which is, you know, laudable in a way, but it's created a situation where he may not get his move in the end because I don't know whether he's driven his own price down by making it other teams aware that he wants to leave. That could have happened.
Elsewhere in Europe, in Germany, wins for Bayern and Dortmund, third favourites at 33-1. Leipzig lost to Schalke, who are fourth favourites at 50-1. I don't know if anyone saw Nikolai Müller, the Hamburg winger, who scored 8 minutes into the season and then ran off to celebrate with a sort of spinny flying kick type thing, and as he landed he did his ACL. Wow. And is out for 7 months, which is, it's just sad for him. In Liga, PSG won 6-2 over Toulouse. A fascinating game. They had Verratti sent off after 69 minutes. It was still 2-1 until the 75th minute when they scored a penalty, and it went 3-1, 3-2, 4-2, 5-2, 6-2 in the last 15 minutes. And there's a lovely clip of Neymar hitting a corner like an arrow. But Philip is here on Thursday, unless you want to add anything. He has things to say about Neymar and Liga. And Neymar has had things to say about Barcelona. And we will chat to Sid about that after this short break. Welcome back to part three of Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain and go straight to Sid Lowe. Hi, Sid.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks very much. Before we go on the pitch, what have you made of these quotes from Neymar about the Barcelona board when he says, I have got something to say, I'm disappointed with them, I spent 4 years there, was very happy, I began happy, spent 4 years happy and left happy, but not with them. For me, they shouldn't be in charge of Barca. Barca deserve much better and everyone knows this.
Yeah, I mean, it's tempting, isn't it, to respond immediately, say, by, if you're going to say Barcelona deserve better, perhaps they deserve Neymar to have stayed and not to have walked out and triggered his buyout clause, although, of course, contractually, he's perfectly entitled to do so. And the context is that Neymar and his father are still fighting Barcelona for that loyalty payment. And obviously the fact that it's called a loyalty payment is kind of comic for having renewed his contract last year, which legally it seems that they're entitled to. So that's the context. The other context, of course, is that he's walked away from the club, that he came to the club with a transfer that has done them a huge amount of damage in terms of the way that it was constructed, the way that it was put together. And also the context of it is that since he's departed, I think he will be very well aware that the way that it's been dealt with, particularly by elements of the Catalan media that he will believe and correctly are close to the club, has been to point the finger at him, to point the finger at his entourage, to point the finger at his father. So that's the context. The worrying thing, I suppose, from Barcelona's board's point of view, will be the realisation that he is not speaking only for himself, or at least the suspicion that he's not speaking only for himself, that other players in the squad will feel the same way, that increasing numbers of fans feel the same way as well, that there's a real push now to try and put pressure on José María Bartomeu, who's the president, and see if he can be forced out. There will be a censorship motion against him, brought against him by one of the former presidential candidates. Joan Laporta, the former president, said yesterday, if we want Messi to be happy, we have to push this guy out now, which of course hints at the suggestion that Messi's not too happy either, that contractual renewal that Messi had hasn't actually been signed yet, even though the club said it had been signed in two different interviews. It's a bit of a mess.
On the pitch, a 2-0 win over Real Betis. I just wondered, given what had happened in Barcelona this week, did it change the atmosphere of that game? You know, and in terms of things like security and you know, was that ramped up around this?
Well, I mean, look, in a way, you know, there aren't adequate words anyway with something like that. And anything you say in any way you look at it can be kind of horribly glib, and it's difficult really to know how to contextualize it. But I think that part of the context, obviously, is that the way that people in Barcelona responded to this, and there was a kind of a simultaneous outbreaking of these shouts after the minute silence the day after the attack, and of that phrase, I'm not scared. You know, and this has been kind of a big thrust of the response to say, right, we're going to prove we're not frightened by this. We're not going to be stopped by this. We're going to carry on. And so, of course, there was, an emotional necessity to try and treat this as normal. And then the reality is that, you know, even people who are very close to it and even people who are very directly affected by it do tend to just try and get on with things. So, of course, the context around it had changed. As you said, the security was greater. For example, I was in Girona, which is 100 kilometres away from Barcelona, the night before, and there were kind of concrete roadblocks to prevent you getting as close to the stadium as you once would have been able to do, partly because it's their first ever game in the first division, so that kind of changes the context as well. But then in Barcelona, yeah, the security was higher, but the sense around the game, I think, was different. There's been suggestions, for example, that, you know, the Barcelona shirt they wore with Barcelona name on the back rather than the players' names. There was a lot of people buying that in the club shop. There was the group of fans behind the goal dressed in black instead of in Barcelona colours as a sign of respect. There were, I think I'm right in saying, in the director's box, an empty seat for each of the victims of the attack. Obviously, the minute silence and so on. So I think the feeling around it, I mean, inevitably, by definition, was different. But then kind of the game goes on, which, as I say, is sort of it feels awkward even just saying that the game goes on and people get on with it, but in truth, once it starts, that kind of does happen.
Yeah, I know, you're totally right. It seems trite to ask a question about the game, yet it's sort of what we're here to do, isn't
but
it?
But exactly, and you know, in a way, in a way, even within the context of the attack, that's kind of what people a sort of saying they want to do. Like, this is the way that you overcome it, is by saying, right, we're not going to be affected by it. We're going to carry on, and we are going to, you know, shout at the referee and moan when a chance gets missed and cheer when a goal goes in. And also, you know, it would also be unfair to kind of expect everybody to be constantly conditioned by it. You know, that people's minds will of course drift to other things.
Yeah. No, I think that, look, I don't know. I mean, this is a football podcast, but I think it's the same in London, isn't it? I think you think about it sometimes, and when you're crossing a bridge, you think about it a bit more, and then you forget about it completely.
Yeah, of course. And when you're close to it, obviously it's different as well. And I was obviously just come back from London, back in Spain now, and actually was on Westminster Bridge the other day. And yeah, you can't help but immediately think about it. But then it is true that, you know, you kind of carry on doing other things.
So on that, two assists for Deulofeu. I mean, I don't think Barcelona fans would expect him to have been doing that a year or two ago?
No, but I mean, I suppose, well, they wouldn't have done as much as anything else because there would have been no anticipation of him having the opportunity. And he's been presented, depending, of course, on what happens with Dembélé, whether they manage to sign him, he's been presented with the opportunity of a lifetime here. When Barcelona bought him back this summer, I think it was 12 million euros, they partly did it because at 12 million euros, you think, well, it would be daft not to. And there was a clause in that agreement that says you don't sell him on straight away. He has to stay for at least a year. But there was still a sense that this is kind of a signing with a view to getting more at some stage. And it was always seen as very unlikely that he would play a significant role. With Neymar's departure, as I say, depending on what happens to Dembélé, there is that opportunity now. Still, I think a lot of people are not entirely convinced because there is a sense that Valverde might go for an extra midfielder rather than have that kind of attacking player up there. Although the formation at the weekend was kind of modified a little bit. But yeah, De La Feo played an important part. I suppose the key really is, can he do it in the big games and the games that really matter? And also, can he kind of come out of his shell a little bit? You see that first Supercopa game against Real Madrid when he's playing with Suarez and Messi. And it did seem very, very inhibited in the way that he played. And I think yesterday obviously will be very good for him, if nothing else, because it will kind of draw him out a little bit.
3-0 win for Real. And Sergio Ramos is his 18th career sending off.
Yeah, I mean, he could have gone actually. He got a yellow card earlier in the game for pushing someone in the face. And in fairness to Ramos, I thought he was subjected to a little bit of a headbutt, and he didn't hit the deck, which is kind of what you might have anticipated when someone lays a forehead on you. But he only got a yellow card for that. Then he got a second yellow card for what the referee took to be an elbow. And I suppose this is where I'm in that kind of weird sort of halfway house between being English and Spanish, in that I don't think that's a yellow card. Maybe that's because I'm too English. But then in Spain, you do that see those given as yellow cards almost all the time. And there hasn't actually been a huge amount of complaint about it in Spain.
Producer Jonathan asks, are Atletico Madrid in crisis?
No, but they didn't play well. And Girona, say newly promoted Girona, their first ever season in the first division, were much, much, much the better side for the best part of 60, 70 minutes. 2-0 up, probably could have been more than that. Atletico got it back to 2-2, and then Girona had two chances late on, and a fantastic overhead kick from Marc Muñeza, who, of course, former Stoke player. And Stuani, Middlesbrough legend Stuani, scored two. I don't think Atletico Madrid are in crisis, but it's certainly not the way they expected it. Although, here's one for you. Last season, they opened the season with a draw against Alaves week one, a draw against Leganes week two. The reason that's significant, they were both newly promoted teams. This year, they open with another newly promoted team, Girona, and get a draw. And the day before the game, there was, at the training session, publicly in front of the cameras, Simeone went on a kind of a 15, 20-minute conversation with his starting 11. And everybody, you know, kind of very clear message was, we're not going to let this happen again. We've got to do this right. And they didn't.
Sid, what was made of Diego Costa's comments on Friday? Do you think Atletico will sign him?
Yeah, well, I mean, in a way that obviously everybody, you know, it had the impact that you would expect it to have, and it was it led the Atletico side of the news agenda here anyway, and there was a real sense, okay, that this moves it closer. Everybody here has taken as, you know, as read that he will eventually join Atletico Madrid, but of course they realise that there's a battle with Chelsea. But the interesting part of it was that new element of him saying, well, if Atletico don't hurry up, I'll look at other clubs. That came as a bit of a surprise because, of course, what Costa's been trying to do is force Chelsea's hand. If you open up other options, what you actually do is allow Chelsea to find a way of you know, getting someone else to bid for you, whereas what he was supposedly trying to do was, you know, kind of make sure it was Atletico Madrid. The assumption, and it is no more than assumption, the assumption is that it will eventually happen. But of course, Atletico Madrid don't want to be put in a position where they have to pay a huge amount of money for him.
Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Tom and Sidlow out in Spain. Did anyone see the Walsall fan who sent a tweet on August the 18th saying, buzzing for tomorrow, hotel booked just 11 miles from Pompey and an absolute bargain, hashtag Saddlers. And then on August the 19th, FFS, this fucking hotel is on the Isle of fucking Wight. I've now got to check in, then get the ferry back. 11 minutes from Pompey, my arse. You can edit that as you see fit. People seem to like the fact that I swore at Barry the other day. The Walsall boss, John Whitney, and his players saw the funny side, have offered to help cover the costs and arranged to meet the van who needlessly took to the high seas to follow them. And speaking of the high seas, this is from Divi Falfan or Divi Fool fan, however you want to pronounce it. Why have World Cup winners had to turn to people smuggling to make a living? Did you see this story?
I did.
This is a magnificent story. Breitbart News, the controversial far-right news organisation, had to apologise after using a picture of former Arsenal striker Lucas Podolski to illustrate a story about migrants travelling from Morocco to Spain. The article was headlined, "Spanish police crack gang moving migrants on jet skis," reporting how smugglers were making money by bringing in migrants across the Straits of Gibraltar. The original picture accompanied the story showed Podolski, who's recently retired from international football, having fun on a jet ski. And there's a quote, they changed the picture, but here's the quote from Breitbart. "There is no evidence Mr. Podolski is either a migrant gang member nor being human trafficked. We wish Mr. Podolski well in his recently announced international retirement." That's a lovely story. A couple of questions for you before we leave. Mr. Gribbles begins by saying, "Are orangutans sceptical to changes in their cages? Also, what's the pod's favourite ever make of football boot?" So you can choose to answer either, but I'd like a football boot answer, please. Paolo.
I'm not sure I even understood the question on orangutans.
No, that's
but,
fine.
For reasons no more clever than because they fit my feet, I've always wanted Adidas boots.
Presumably World Cups, or have you?
No.
You've gone colourful?
No, I've always worn black boots because I'm crap at football, so okay. I think it's a bad idea for me to wear colourful boots. Just plain, cheap black Adidas boots.
Ed, I mean, your football ability first. Did you have trials at Palace?
I'd like to think I'm not bad.
Okay.
Still playing, actually.
Oh, really?
Still playing.
Saturdays?
Yeah. In the financial leagues, London's financial leagues. Very, very tough.
Yeah, I imagine.
I've still got the same pair of boots that I had in this. Well, I'll tell you the name of them. This will show you how old they are. They're Nike's Ronaldinho specials. With maroon laces.
It indicates you haven't used them that much.
No, I have used them a lot.
Oh, really?
Just haven't bought another pair, and they've got holes in now. I probably need to buy a new pair.
Jacob?
I think the boots I own are Nike. I've worn them for a while.
Okay. So,
yeah. They're silver, I think.
I'm a Puma King man, yeah. As it goes. I did flirt with red once. I'm too slow. Obviously, people want to kick me anyway. Ben asks, "Is Barry missing the pod because he's too busy trolling the Nevilles?" I don't know if anyone saw Barry and Phil Neville have a little row yesterday. Phil said he's, as a traditionalist, he was upset to see Premier League games taking place at Wembley. Barry might have had a few and said, "As a traditionalist, why did you change Salford's kit?" And then it got very technical.
Oh, really?
He was just dropped. He was just dropped for today. Ed asks, "If you met someone in a pub and they told you they were a football club's mascot, costumed mascot, how quickly would you get away from them?"
Were they costumed at the time when I met them?
I think if they were costumed at the time and they had to tell you that they were the costume mascot, it would indicate that you'd had too many and you would have to leave anyway.
They might have turned up as the mascot. That might have been their favourite thing about the club. They might have just been a fan of the mascot.
It's possibly true, isn't it? Do you think there are people
replica
who
mascot kit?
Do you think there are people
the
who
next level of the full kit?
Really? Are there people who dress as Gunnosaurus?
Yeah,
they buy the whole outfit.
Well, I think that would be a very good fancy dress outfit for a start.
Would you wear it? Would you wear it in a pod?
I don't know if the Arsenal fan would go as Gunnosaurus.
I'm not sure I'd fit in this seat as Gunnosaurus. Quite wide around the waist.
I'd have to go as Hammerhead.
Would you go, is that what you are?
That's the weird.
What a Palace?
Well, Palace have got Pete and Alice the Eagle, so.
That's true.
Yeah, and I think they got married, actually.
Oh, that's nice.
There was a ceremony, and I wasn't invited.
Yeah. I did get some stick from Palace fans. I tried to rectify it by complaining that the flags were put out by the club, because I presume they were, but they were put out by the Palace Ultras.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't take any credit for that, I'm afraid.
Did you enjoy Harry Arter?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Because it was Chalabar's dummy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To Harry Arter.
Because he shouted leave.
He shouted leave it. Mm. Or I wondered if maybe Harry Arter's a very good impressionist and can do all the Watford players. He impersonated Etienne Capoue. He does a great Etienne Capoue. Maybe Harry Arter can do every Premier League player, you know, and he can, in any game, he can do that.
It's quite a useful skill, really, isn't it? If you, I mean, as long as the referee doesn't hear, because technically he should have been.
It should have been a free kick.
This is like the guy on Police Academy. I can't think what his name
is. Yeah, he can do sound effects as well.
Like helicopters and guns. And, yeah.
Finally, did anyone see at the Brighton Leicester game, there was a half and half scarf, half Craig Shakespeare and half Chris Hughton. Was it their names or their faces? What was it?
Either way.
Hugh Spear.
Is this Hugh Spear?
Or
yes.
Or
Shakton. Either way. Wow. Either way, football is finally over. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Jacob.
Thanks.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paolo.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Thursday. The lineup for Thursday: Eau Claire, Doyle, Christensen. Is that right? Exciting time. See you then.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.